Our third case this morning, State of Ohio versus Frederick M. Weber. For the appellant, Mr. Palmer.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor, Associate Justices. Steve Palmer here on behalf of Mr. Weber. Good morning, Mr. Horton. I want to first start by saying what we are proposing, and maybe more important, what we are not proposing. We are just proposing this, that law-abiding citizens in their own home have an absolute right to own, possess, use, or carry a firearm. People who aren't law-abiding citizens, or those who are committing crimes, perhaps, with the firearm, don't fit in with the core protection of the Second Amendment. Intoxication, in and of itself, is not a crime. And one who is engaged in drinking alcohol or some other intoxicant that is lawful is a law-abiding citizen. And really, the inquiry ends there under Heller or D.C. versus Heller. So now what we have to do is figure out what is a couple of things, frankly. One, what is the standard of review to be applied post-Heller here in Ohio, as well as the federal concerns about the same issues? And our position, of course, is going to be strict scrutiny. Every single district, every court, Ohio or federal.
And if it's strict scrutiny, what has to be shown?
Well, if it's strict scrutiny, it's got to be the least drastic means. It's got to be so narrowly tailored that it's very difficult to overcome.
To preserve a legitimate state interest.
Correct.
All right. And would you start with there's a legitimate state interest for public safety at present here?
Well, there's an interest in public safety, and I suppose to the extent that alcohol and firearms, and looking at the amicus briefs, looking at the various arguments, I can understand while in public, in the context of being around other people in public, there's an interest.
What's the difference if somebody is in your home and injured or on the street and injured?
Well, there's two differences. The first is fundamentally under the Second Amendment, under Heller and under all its progeny, everybody agrees that the core activity protected by the Second Amendment is to own and possess and keep firearms within the home. So that's the first.
That's
problem.
Not absolute. There's restrictions that can be, like any right. There's a duty. There's the ability for the state to impose legislation regarding that right.
Well, that's a matter of degree, perhaps, and I would suggest this, that the courts that have addressed regulations or restrictions on the Second Amendment, from what I have seen so far, haven't really done so in the context or the confines of the home, except for Heller itself, which basically was a gentleman who wanted to own and possess a handgun in his home.
But, Counselor, I think that you're arguing something too broad. This isn't about owning or possessing a firearm in his home. This is about carrying one while intoxicated.
Well, it's a good question, and I've given that a lot of thought, because here's the problem. If we look at this snapshot in time, there's a gentleman, Mr. Weber. In his home, he's intoxicated. We'll just accept that as true. And he's holding an unloaded shotgun facing down by the stock. Again, in any other context, that's leave out the alcohol component, it's a perfectly lawful activity. And the only thing that makes that unlawful is the fact that he's intoxicated, and that's why we're here. So that's the question we're begging anyway.
But, Counsel, his right to own a gun is not at play here. He can be intoxicated and own a gun.
Sure.
Okay, it's the mix of being intoxicated and having that control over that gun, using that gun.
Absolutely. And I looked back through many, many decisions of 29, 23, 15. Not all of them. In fact, there are various ones, individuals charged with this crime, not just holding it. In fact, next to them, perhaps on a car seat, in a glove compartment, on the floor of a car.
But that's not this case, though.
No, that's not this case. But that does show that just holding on to it is not the only qualifier or the only
thing. But you have an as-applied challenge, so it has to be the facts of this case.
Well, sure. We look at the snapshot of this case, and those are the facts of the case. And I think this gentleman, as he's standing there, has every right under the Second Amendment in his own home, intoxicated or not, to be holding on to a firearm. The reason I bring up other of those things, aside from the question, of course, is that we have a situation where it can drag into the net all sorts of other scenarios, because if one is to defend himself or herself or his family or her family within the home and happens to be intoxicated.
That sounds like a really good case, but we don't. But again, I don't understand the relevance, because we don't have that case in front of us, right? You're challenging the statute as applied to you.
Sure.
And I agree, those others would make some really interesting cases for us to decide. Maybe we will someday, but we have to talk about your case.
I would submit the following. I would submit we do have that case, in the sense that if you have an individual who is holding a firearm for any purpose at all, they're going to get caught up in this problem, just like Mr. Weber did.
Right. But you're making an as-applied challenge. You understand that that means that it's how the statute is applied to your client.
It's how it's applied to the set of facts here. And I suppose we can narrow the lens very closely and determine that we have to only create a specific situation. Federal courts, the U.S. Supreme Court, and various courts, I tried to come up with a way to help define what as applied is. And I think in order to
as applied is pretty simple. It's just applied to the facts in front of us. So it's not any more difficult than that.
Well, fair enough. Then I would say the facts in front of us are, we have a gentleman holding a firearm for any purpose at all, is going to be charged or can be charged with this offense. And I submit that under Heller, that's unconstitutional. He's in his home. He is possessing, using a firearm, and he's intoxicated. But short of that, he's not committing any offense.
How could the state have made the statute more narrow?
I believe, and we propose, that it is fairly simple to create a statute that comports with Heller and the rest of the Second Amendment authority. And that is this. If we had a statute that said that this offense does not apply to those engaged as lawful citizens in lawful behavior, intoxicated or not, but if you're engaged in unlawful behavior and you're intoxicated, well, clearly the statute applies. And that by and large is what the case law suggests.
Well, but that then requires the individual to know whether his or her conduct is lawful. I mean, which could, you know, I can't think off the top of my head, but I mean, my problem with it, with the statute more honestly, is, you know, it doesn't make a distinction between whether the firearm is loaded or unloaded. Because if Mr. Weber was intoxicated lawfully in his own home, he's above the age of, you know, permissible for drinking, and he had a loaded shotgun, arguably there might be some greater safety issues involved there. But in this case, as you mentioned, it was unloaded. He let the police officers know that. The wife, I think, said he had put it down. It was carried with the barrel downward. So, you know, could those factors be used to tailor the statute to a more narrow?
Perhaps, but the General Assembly might run afoul of a whole body of case law on operability of firearms, right, and whether they have to be loaded during criminal behavior. Mm-hmm. I think a cleaner distinction is to say, if you've got a weapon, a firearm, in your home, intoxicated or not, and you're not engaged in any unlawful behavior, whether that be disorderly conduct, assault.
But would you agree that you're impaired?
Sure.
So why isn't there a public safety interest in not having someone who is impaired carrying a firearm?
Well, there may be a public safety interest in that, and particularly in the public sector or the public realm. But in the home, that is the core of the Second Amendment protection.
But you have law enforcement officers in that home at the time, so public safety extends to them.
Law enforcement officers were at the door, and they knocked on a door. They weren't, so they were there by the call. But generally speaking, Mr. Weber was not engaged in any unlawful conduct aside from the fact that this statute made it unlawful. In other words, he wasn't threatening anybody.
But that's like most of our crimes. The statutes make it unlawful.
All right, we'll call it malum in se, then, or things that are not just regulatory. And that's one of the problems with the statute. There are no exceptions. It's strict liability. It's not like necessity would offer a defense. It's not like it offers an exception within its own verbiage for somebody who might be carrying a gun or using a gun or even holding a gun, as in this case, in their own home.
And as you tried to bring up, if Mr. Weber heard an intruder and had this weapon and was intoxicated, it would, this violation would still apply to him?
It would still apply. And then you can, you know, despite the as-applied challenge, Your Honor, I mean, this is a situation where a picture perhaps a young female who fears that somebody at a bar is stalking her or going to do her harm. She goes home. She gets an Uber home because she uses a safe word with the bartender, perhaps. She goes to her home, locks her door, puts a pistol on her lap, and maybe she's been drugged herself, or maybe she's just intoxicated voluntarily, and the police knock on the door, thank heavens, they've captured the intruder or the stalker, she's committing a crime. And that
isn't protection of herself or self-defense a viable defense to use?
Frankly, no. I don't believe it is. Under the strict liability statute here, it's not, it's not that
Counsel, that's not our case.
Obviously, that's not our case. Our case is the person holding a firearm in their home. And then this law that we create here today, though, will be applied to all those scenarios. Is it unlawful in your home to have a firearm, even though you're intoxicated? And again, given the sort of broader interpretation and enforcement of the weapon while intoxicated.
So you would have us give, in essence, permission for someone who's intoxicated to have their AR-14 or 15, whatever it is, in their hands, in their home.
I don't know
while intoxicated, and have their grandchildren around.
What I'm saying, look, that is far from prudent behavior, I'll agree, but it's not that I'm asking this court to give permission to that conduct. I am suggesting
okay,
that the Second
saying,
Amendment.
Okay, if you're saying, if what you want us to say here, which is in the home, whether you're sober or not, whether you've got a gun that is loaded or not, there is no law that is broken.
That's correct. I mean, assuming the gun is lawful and the conduct is lawful.
Well, okay, yeah. but that's what you, so, imagine the ramifications that kind of a opinion would have.
I think what the issue is, as soon as the conduct crosses over to unlawful, as soon as the conduct becomes in and of itself unlawful, now the possession of a weapon while intoxicated or under the influence of alcohol or a dangerous drug or drug of abuse is a crime, and that's perfectly valid to regulate. So
you have to have another crime being committed in order to say you've got a crime of being intoxicated or impaired and holding a weapon.
In a home. Correct. Under the Second Amendment, I think that's absolutely
right. So the state doesn't have any interest, a legitimate interest in protecting the occupants of that home or the visitors to that home. The sanctity of the home is surpasses all of that.
Yes. I think the owner of the home, the occupants of the home, have that same obligation to protect those in it. And if we...
Wait a minute. The owner of the home has an obligation to protect those in the home.
Correct.
Okay, we're saying the owner of the home is impaired and is in possession of a weapon. How is he protecting or she protecting anybody?
Well, if the person's impaired in possession of a weapon, I mean, I would love to tell you that it would never happen that somebody could invade the home in that very scenario, but it's very possible that happens, and in fact, equally possible it happens when somebody hasn't consumed alcohol, that they're going to have to procure a firearm that they keep in their nightstand or that they keep in their safe. Or maybe they sleep with under their pillow because they've been attacked before. And what we're doing is forcing folks into an unconstitutional choice between exercising their constitutional right to have a firearm in their hearth and home, or if they like to consume alcohol, either socially or otherwise, it's the law-abiding folks who will say, all right, well, I'm just going to get rid of my guns. The criminals aren't going to get
Nobody's
rid of their
Nobody's saying
guns.
Get rid of your gun. Nobody's saying you can't own a gun. You can't have a gun in your home properly stored or whatever. You just can't handle it, use it, while you're intoxicated. That's the only restriction here. There's no restriction on gun ownership, and that's a confusion that you're creating here.
I don't mean to suggest any confusion. I've got a minute left, but I'd like to reserve whatever I have. But what I'm saying is, Those who are going to be to try to follow this law and they like to drink, it's not that they can't own a gun, but they may just possess themselves of it to avoid a problem here while the criminals will not. I will reserve the rest of my time, albeit short, for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Horton.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. Justices, may it please the court, my name is Nick Horton. I represent the state of Ohio. Your Honors, the issue here in this case is establishing a standard of review in determining the constitutionality of statutes involving firearms and determining whether 292315 is unconstitutional in this case.
Do we have to establish a standard of review? I mean, if you look at what about the position that, say, Justice Kavanaugh, Judge Batchelder, or others have taken that to really the Second Amendment is not like equal protection or other scenarios, and what we really ought to be doing is looking at the scope of the right at the time of the founding or the time of the Ohio Constitution.
Sure, and that's the first step in the two-step.
They would say it's the only step. Kavanaugh says it's the only step, that you never get to the second step.
That's true. However, Justice Scalia, writing for the court in Heller, repeatedly referred to the Second Amendment in the same context as the First Amendment and said that that under any standard of scrutiny, that the law in Heller was unconstitutional. Now, there was no reason for the for Justice Scalia to say under any standard of scrutiny if it didn't mean, and to continually refer to the Second Amendment and the First Amendment, if it did not mean that that there is some standard of scrutiny out there to make these determinations. And as the court held, it's the right is not unlimited. The defendant here has said that law-abiding citizens have the right to keep and bear firearms. The problem with that is that the defendant leaves out an important word that Justice Scalia put in the Heller decision. It said law-abiding, responsible citizens have the right to keep and bear arms for the defense of our
home. So people who drink are irresponsible by nature?
No, not necessarily. So people who drink and engage in the activity of carrying or using a firearm are doing so irresponsibly, just as someone who is drinking to the point of intoxication is not necessarily irresponsible. Someone who is driving is not irresponsible, but someone who is drinking to the point of intoxication and driving is irresponsible.
Well, but driving is a privilege and is not a right.
True. True. However, the right is not unlimited. And the problem, another problem with applying the holdings, the decisions of Judge Batchelder or Justice Kavanaugh is that it's reliant on the court's holding that it was not going to apply the interest-based balancing test from Justice Breyer. Now, the argument goes that what Justice Breyer was saying in his interest-based balancing test was essentially intermediate scrutiny. And so what Justice Kavanaugh and Judge Batchelder are essentially saying is that the court is ruling out intermediate scrutiny. The problem with that is that Justice Scalia says we know of no other enumerated right that is subject to a freestanding interest-based balancing test. Now, if what the court meant was we know of no other enumerated right that is subject to an intermediate scrutiny test, because those are presumably interchangeable under that theory, that's problematic because the First Amendment, there are numerous cases that have been decided under intermediate scrutiny. So either Justice Scalia had a tenuous grasp of the First Amendment, which I seriously doubt, or the court did not mean intermediate scrutiny when it talked about interest-based balancing test,
Counsel,
which I think is the case.
If we could, no matter what standard of review we're going to use, can you articulate for me the state's interest in precluding somebody carrying an unloaded firearm
Sure.
in their home while intoxicated? What's the state's interest in limiting that behavior?
So it's not clear that the danger in carrying an unloaded firearm is substantially mitigated, in carrying a firearm is substantially mitigated by the fact that it's unloaded. Especially in this case, we know that the defendant had just unloaded it. He said to wipe it down. So there is ammunition readily available, unless we're talking about like a Civil War musket, it's easy to load a firearm. And so it's not clear that the danger is mitigated to an extent that the state would not still have a strong interest in precluding someone from only during the part that they are or time that they are intoxicated from carrying or using the firearm when the danger is at its most acute.
Well, Counselor, and I know this is an as-applied case to Mr. Weber, but wouldn't this statute then preclude someone who is intoxicated in his or her home from having, handling, using a firearm for protection?
Not necessarily. So there was a case out of the 8th District, State versus Hardy, and in that case, the defendant was under a disability. His wife owned a firearm, and she owned the business that he worked at. A disgruntled employee came in, tried to rob the store. The employee tried to grab the gun. The defendant was able to wrestle it from him. The employee came at him with some sharp object, a knife or something, and the defendant used the firearm to shoot the employee. And what the 8th District said there was the defendant did not have the weapon for purposes of 29-23-13, my apologies, which I think would be a similar case here if that happened.
The scenario that was given earlier, someone came home after drinking, came home Uber, thought someone was following, sat bedside or sat in the living room with gun loaded in her lap.
So there's no restriction on being intoxicated in your own home and having a loaded firearm near at hand. Now, that was not the case in, say, Michigan, where they had issues with constructive possession. That's not an issue.
In her lap, in her hand.
Right.
Finger on trigger.
Sure, sure. So in that sense, it would be more like Martz or Smead, where the defendant had the firearm sort of preemptively. So it wouldn't protect a preemptive possession of the firearm, but if it came to fruition that someone intruded in her home and she had a firearm in her home, she would be, I think, lawfully or within her right to grab the firearm and repel the intruder. And I don't know of any prosecutor in the state of Ohio that's going to prosecute that case, which I think is why we have a dearth of case law since.
Right, but you give the scenario if someone intrudes and she can grab, no one intrudes and the firearm is in her hand. She's right. In violation of the statute.
Yes, yes. And I think, and again, that goes to there can't be a preemptory possession without, they can't wait for the danger to come to them. If the danger comes to them, if they are imperiled, then they can grab a firearm that they have in the home and use it to repel the intruder.
So the message here is if you're intoxicated, lawfully or unlawfully, if you're intoxicated, you cannot have a firearm in your possession.
You cannot carry or use a firearm. You may have it in the home.
Right, but right,
yes.
You can't have it physical
yes,
possession.
Yes, correct, yes.
Counsel, let's go. I want to go back to the strict scrutiny issue. Cases on both constitutions, right? We're here in front of both constitutions.
Yes.
The state constitution, we're not required to follow the federal case law, are
no.
we?
No.
So what standard would be the state under the state constitution?
So I think it would still be the same. This court in Arnold held that the Ohio Constitution protected more rights than the Second Amendment. However, when Arnold was decided, there was still the prevailing thought that the Second Amendment protected collective rights, not an individual right. And so the distinguishing factor in Arnold between the Ohio Constitution and the federal Constitution was that the state protected the individual's right to bear arms.
Because of the wording of the state constitution for
yes.
their defense and security,
yes.
correct?
Yes.
So that is different than in the federal Constitution.
Than the language, but not in the interpretation. After Heller, what the court said was an individual has the right to protect hearth and home. And so the interpretation of the rights, the particular rights, there is no distinction now, or that distinction that was present in Arnold is no longer present. And
that still doesn't require us to follow the federal standards, correct?
It does not, no. So it would mean that this court would either have to apply something akin to strict scrutiny or an absolute ban on infringement on the right. Well, it couldn't be an absolute ban on the infringement because this court has repeatedly noted that it is not limited, or that it is, that the right on bearing arms can be limited.
We could adopt the Batchelder test, couldn't we?
So the Batchelder test and the test that is proposed by Justice Kavanaugh is closer to sort of an absolute standard, where if there is no historical analog, or if it was not known historically as falling under the Second Amendment, then there can be no law.
I understand what the standard is. I'm asking, can we adopt it?
No, I don't believe so, because I think that is essentially an absolute prohibition, with the exception of prohibitions that were historically understood to fall outside the Second Amendment. And I think the United States, the court in Heller, indicated that there are a number of presumptively lawful prohibitions that were longstanding, like prohibition against felons or the mentally ill. And the mentally ill goes only back to 1968.
So. Could we adopt the federal strict scrutiny standard under the state constitution?
This court could. However, we would be going from the standard in Arnold and Klein, which was it couldn't be unreasonable or arbitrary, and that had to have a real and substantial relation to the government interest in protecting the health, safety, and welfare of the general public. And so to go from there to a strict scrutiny standard is a fairly giant leap with no real changes to the case law or to the Constitution that would warrant a jump from what is arguably somewhere between rational basis and intermediate scrutiny to strict scrutiny. Now, this court could absolutely do so. However, there does not seem to be a basis in the case law to support such a decision. In this case, this statute is narrowly tailored to serve a significant governmental interest. So even if this court applied a strict scrutiny standard or intermediate scrutiny standard, I think this statute would pass constitutional muster. This court stated in Arnold that the legislature's ability to protect the public is not a police power objective, it's a mandate. And
is that analysis the same, though, within the confines of your home?
I'm sorry.
Was that analysis that you're talking about, is that the same within the confines of your home as opposed to outside, more public public safety issues on the street in a public place?
Yes, because the law is to protect the public, whether it's inside the home or outside the home. And we know from Bureau of Justice statistics that was cited in the state's brief that the majority of firearm violence takes place inside the home. And we know that coupled with intoxication, which lowers a person's ability to self-control, that presents a unique, dangerous situation. So whether it's inside the home or outside the home, if it poses a risk to other people, I think that is absolutely the purview of the General Assembly. And this is...
Let me assume that we do think it's important what the historical evidence was. What is that? Would this kind of restriction have been okay at the time of the founding or the time of the adoption of the Ohio Constitution, 1853?
I believe so. And in a In addition to the history at the time of the enactment or the ratification, what Heller tells us is that you look to subsequent interpretations to see what the general understanding of the law was. And so I think we see with the enactment of the statutes in Kansas and Mississippi and Missouri and so forth, that states had the belief that they could constitutionally prohibit someone from carrying while intoxicated. And this court in State versus Hogan talked about carrying a firearm for unvirtuous citizens, essentially the tramp law, and found that a person may carry for their protection of the home, protection of the country, but they cannot carry in a way that would terrorize or create a dangerous situation, which is what we have in this case. We'd ask for this court to affirm. There are no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, you have less than a minute.
Thank you. With respect to the last comment about unvirtuous or virtuous conduct here, Mr. Weber was not engaged in any unvirtuous conduct. He wasn't terrorizing anybody. There's no evidence to that effect. This is, in fact, a strict liability offense.
Do you have any? I'm over here. I'm sorry.
Sorry, Mike.
No, I'm over here.
I got you.
Do you have any historical evidence that at the time that the Second Amendment was adopted, or the time the Ohio constitutional provision was adopted, that it was understood that there was a right to be drunk and carry a firearm?
Well, I'm not going to cite any historical evidence, but I would suggest this. Alcohol has been a part of this culture since the inception. And to think that those in their homes wouldn't consume alcohol and have firearms around seems a little bit of a stretch. And in fact, if there's going to be any place where you could do that, it would be in the home. And in fact, Heller actually cites a legal historical document or a commentary that cites Ohio's Constitution for the proposition that Ohio fundamentally establishes the right in the sanctity of the home.
Counsel, the state of Ohio has an interest in protecting Mr. Weber from causing harm to himself, right?
Sure, yes.
So he said he was cleaning his gun and admitted he was intoxicated.
Yes.
So
I don't think there was any evidence at all that he was acting in a dangerous manner with it. I don't think there was any evidence at all that he needed protection from himself.
Do you think the act of cleaning a gun while you're intoxicated and your ability to make sure that it's unloaded is enough?
Well, no, I don't in and of itself. I think just saying somebody's intoxicated and therefore unable to clean an unloaded gun, again, while that might not be prudent behavior and obviously should be discouraged, I'm
assuring the fact that it's unloaded is the risk here.
Of course.
Okay, which a state would have the interest in saying, you know, intoxicated, impaired, the likelihood of you not unloading your gun safely or completely is increased.
Well, again, the state
would you agree with that?
I would agree that the state has that interest. I would also say, however, that the Second Amendment protects the conduct. So there, we run into these situations where we do have protected constitutional conduct. The state would also have an interest in governing people's speech, I'm sure, when they get intoxicated and start saying things that are later regretted. But it doesn't mean they can do it, or it doesn't mean the state can do it. It's still protected constitutional behavior. And again, the same.
So if someone is intoxicated and is spewing hate, inciting violence, doing all those things, the state has no right to intervene there.
The state has every right to intervene because at that point the speech isn't protected. At that point that becomes unprotected speech. What the state cannot do is say you're not allowed to engage in speech because you're intoxicated.
Well, nobody is saying that. There is no. There is. Okay, the comparison is not, very likely. Nobody is saying that your client can't own a gun. Nobody says that he can't have the gun in the same room with him. It's the fact that he's intoxicated and is in possession of the gun is the problem.
Well, the possession in the same room or holding, and now again, as applied in this case, that Mr. Weber was holding his firearm, but I would submit that if it were sitting next to him, we would still be here. If it were sitting close to him, we would still be here, because the statute strikes a little broader than that, albeit the facts in this situation are that he was actually holding it. So then that chills the conduct that is the core protected activity of the Second Amendment, that is to own, possess, use a firearm, not just in self-defense, but in case of self-defense for the security, if you're going to use Ohio's statute 9.68. Absent any other questions, I think I have exhausted my time.
You have. Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision.